This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A soul that is not confused is not a soul. So says Segyo, a 12th century Japanese monk and poet, and so agrees Howard Norman. The author of the celebrated novels The Bird Artist and The Northern Lights says he's carried that philosophy with him throughout his life as he struggles to find clarity and balance. His latest book, the wonderfully named I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place, I can't even say it here, I'm ruining the beautifully named book, I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place. It's a memoir, but it reads like a series of interconnected short stories. Norman recounts a few of the strange and confusing incidents that have shaped his life, muddling his soul. He emerges from these tales with that greater clarity he seeks, sometimes realizing only in retrospect that he's following a distinct path. Howard Norman spends his summers in a farmhouse in East Callis, leaving his teaching job in Maryland behind to immerse himself in a rural life that he clearly treasures. And Howard Norman joins me today to talk about that life and the stories he tells in his new memoir. What a pleasure to have you on the program with us.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So your uncle Isidore asks you in one chapter of this book, what is it with you and birds? And birds feature so heavily into this memoir of yours. So what is it with you and birds?
Well, of course, in the context of that chapter, one has to put a slight Eastern European inflection on his question. But it's a hard thing to talk about. I mean, in a little bit in your introduction, you incorporate a kind of theological aspect to this book. And I think birds are spiritual for me. I'm loath to use that in any kind of rhetorical way, but it's perhaps as much the place that birds live, the landscape, that registers so deeply with me, strikes such deep chords. And I would say for me, Northern California, especially the Point Reyes National Seashore, which seems a time out of place in a way, is iconic in that regard for me.
When we do mic checks at the beginning of a program to get the sound level of a person's voice to make sure that we have the microphones on correctly, we usually ask people what they had for breakfast, but I asked you to tell us what birds you'd seen this morning, and you said crows.
Crows. There was a neighborhood gathering the other night, and it was so striking to me when my neighbors and my family get together, there's oftentimes a kind of mandatory or at least expected discussion on what animals have been viewed in the neighborhood in Callis. And
that seems like a pretty Vermont-centric conversation anyway.
To me, it does. And it is a way of expressing your alertness and letting people know what's going on. It's quite wonderful. Well, the other night, wonderful naturalist Eric Sorensen was at the table, and he listened to everyone's description of a particular bird. It was like when people call into the car talk guys and try to describe an engine noise. And Eric, who's very, very poised, listened carefully and said, "Oh, well, that's a black-billed cuckoo." And of course, it solved the ornithological mystery right away. And the sense of relief and gratefulness was palpable and full of humor. And that's what I mean. If birds or the observation of wildlife can be incorporated into quotidian thinking, I'm very comfortable with that.
So even the ravens, you find something spiritual in them?
Of course, especially in regard to Native American myths. Ravens, in many traditions, as you know, were the creators of Earth. They're trickster figures, very powerful presences, and probably quite easy to anthropomorphize.
In the first chapter of your memoir, you write a lot about the swans that sailed around a pond near where you lived, a lake near where you lived when you were a young person, and you swam with them. In the summertime, you'd slip into the water at night and try to swim alongside these swans, but you had to keep your wits up because, as people know, swans are not always nice creatures. They can bite pretty hard.
They can be very aggressive. When you finish writing something, you often look back at it later and see what you've actually written. And in this case, this whole memoir was a discovery of the origins of some of the obsessions and preoccupations and behaviors of fictional characters. Having said that, the swan at Reed's Lake that I tried to trap and who drowned, that was a formative event. And although I didn't use those terms at the time, I was 15, I realized that years later, publishing a book called Devotion, which has a swan on the cover and is partly about the swan, the queen's swan keeper in England, that probably there's some lineage there, although hard to delineate perfectly. I'm not suggesting that writing about swans or writing about birds is a literary form of redemption. I'm simply saying that there are certain things that happen that seem to keep resonating or divvying themselves out in your conscious or unconscious mind. And since writing is the way one organizes one's emotions, let alone memories, it makes certain sense that that swan will keep coming back in various forms, obviously.
Well, it was also clearly a very traumatic event. I mean, you built a trap and you mistakenly trapped this swan, then was in agony and drowned itself, went under in this trap.
It did go under, and the acoustics of that still, I can still hear. You know, there is an erotic element to that anecdote too, because this lake is where one would jump in to cool off, and my older brother and some of his friends would go to this nearby sort of makeout place near there and with their cars. This is, of course, in the 50s in the Midwest. And so the proximity to that and I suppose the erotic nature of swans in mythologies, one could see a swirling together of various symbols, but only in retrospect. At the time, and I don't mean this as a pun, one is just immersed in things in life. I think what was really shocking was that how one's desires to trap something, to be close to it, to have a hands-on experience with a wild creature can lead to something fatal. That registers very deeply in my mind.
It, as I was reading that part of the book, I wondered why you shared that story. You mentioned that you still feel guilt over killing this swan some 50 years later. But if I might also borrow another bird metaphor, it almost felt like you were dropping your albatross at the reader's feet, that you had been carrying this burden around for 50 years and you felt the need to unburden yourself.
I think if there was a subtitle in my mind to this book, that is a sponsoring philosophy, it would be against closure. Closure is one of these words that is in the public domain, and it assumes or presumes that coming to terms with something will end its presence in your life, grief, sadness, love. So by no means did the writing about that swan end the connection to it. It just simply organized it and put it out there. You asked the question of why write that. Well, of course, the selecting process is very succinct and hardly arbitrary. But I think the unifying element between all these anecdotes in this book and scenarios and memories is that I didn't want to feel hypocritical and coy and suggest that there were things I wasn't telling. At the same time, one needs to have some discretion and tell only a certain amount. So I think that's the paradox and the attempt to be measured in one's writing.
I'm talking with Howard Norman, the author of a new memoir, I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place. And listeners, if you have read Howard Norman's fiction, The Northern Lights, The Bird Artist, and loved them. If you have questions about some of the origins of the characters that might be revealed in a memoir, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Michael of the Vergennes Union High School who emailed in to say, I teach in Vermont today in part because 30 years ago I had the opportunity to meet Howard when he spoke to an anthropology class on oral poetry at Boston University. His stories about the Cree Indians and their oral traditions influenced me greatly and led to me doing similar work in South America. I've always wanted to thank him for that short but profound encounter as well as for his books.
Goodness, that's a lovely surprise. I can't imagine me being influential to anyone, but I'm sure glad to hear that.
Can you talk a little bit about your experiences working with Native peoples? You worked a lot up in Arctic Canada. You did some translations. You write about this in the book as well.
About a 9 or 10 year period, roughly, and in increments and in overlapping experiences. I was working in the Arctic. I still stay quite closely in touch with the language. My job basically was to record and transcribe in language-intensive circumstances life histories, folk tales, mythologies, songs, the whole oral tradition. Life histories, of course, are not part of traditional thought. Those are things that are imposed, the template of a life history. But it was extraordinary experience, not only emotionally and, again, perhaps spiritually, if you will, but literarily, because when you – if there was anything close to an apprenticeship that I had and I wasn't formally trained in writing or literature, it was that, because you listen to these Inuit stories, and sometimes they have three beginnings and four middles, and they might suggest an ending or other compositions and structures, symphonic structures that do not fit what we might think of as the Western tradition. And it teaches you all sorts of ways to think narratively that I would have not had otherwise. And almost every day I look at some of that work, and it's quite an unusual experience, not without its difficulties, as this chapter in this book indicates, because you are an interloper, you are an outsider, you do represent a kind of colonial sensibility, whether you want that or not. And so there were confrontations, difficulties, tensions. On the other hand, I met people who still remain extremely important to me, and I wrote about this in a book called "In Fond Remembrance of Me." It was about a Japanese woman I met in Churchill, who was a far better linguist than I was, and it was a place you met people who you almost felt could live nowhere else but those places. I was not one of those.
Can you talk a little bit about this story that you recount in the book? Because you mentioned that you were translating a lot of legends and myths and stories that were important to the cultures that you were visiting in and being an interloper in. But you also found yourself taken up with them because they feel very real when you're in them. And there was an Inuit shaman who appeared in the town that you were working in and took an immediate disliking to you. And maybe it was because of that vision of colonial power. But you found yourself really rattled by this man.
In that place in the Northwest Territories, I had gone on assignment. It was employment. And I think that's worth underlining or underscoring just for a moment so that there isn't an overly romantic aspect to all of this. This was the employment I had. This was work. This was translation work. This was work sponsored by various organizations, museums, and private organizations. And these Angakoks, or shamans, were really profound individuals. I ran into a number of them. The one in the Northwest Territories that I write about certainly had a predisposition toward anyone who would come in there. But I think it was because I was there later than most people. I was there into the winter. That's an unusual thing. But right from the get-go, he was aggressive. And at first, there was a comical aspect to it. But quite quickly, I became very aware that there was a potential for violence. And rather than express this as a kind of melodrama, I started experiencing it as related to the stories I was translating. This is a guy that actually stepped right out of one of these stories and therefore stepped out of the landscape there. They usually stay away from towns or villages until the weather changes and people leave the last mail plane or such. And he was very, very aggressive. I had a number which I do give an account of confrontations with him. He won out. I mean, there was a kind of battle of wills, and I really didn't have a chance. So all these years later, writing about it, sometimes writing about things that happened that long ago has that seance quality to it, where things come back with vivid immediacy, but there's still a kind of dreamlike quality. Not with him. When I think about him, I still can remember very tangibly what it was like to deal with him. Very impressive. And by the way, there's no judgments there. I understood his attitude toward me and, you know, accepted it.
There's a moment where he threatens to put you into a snow globe. And as you said, it's a scene that could be seen as humorous, except it is sort of an allegory. And he doesn't. You leave. But before you do, you talk with one woman who tells you another story, another sort of mythological story that seems to be about you. She seems to have taken this story that a visitor comes to the village and is put into a snow globe. And so you sort of became part of this mythology as well. It's being written as it's being lived in a way.
I think that's accurate technically. I was once walking in Nova Scotia along a beach and came to the point where the rain ended. And I thought to myself, well, of course it has to end somewhere, but you never really think you'll experience it. Well, I think that period of time in the Northwest Territories, I did experience the origin of a particular small little story, because it was about a man who a shaman threatened to put inside a snow globe. And it was obviously starting to be told actually during the time I was there. And I didn't know that till I was about to leave. Now, I would look back at that and I consider that a kind of oral epitaph. Maybe that's what I should have on my gravestone.
What would it say?
Well, it may be the whole story that she told.
That would be a very long gravestone.
I'd have to get a sculptor, you know, to do that. But
we're talking today with Howard Norman about his new memoir, I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place. You can give us a call with your thoughts for him. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or join the conversation on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with the author Howard Norman. He is the author of What Is Left, The Daughter, The Bird Artist, and now a memoir called I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place. In it, he details some of the incidents of arresting strangeness that have happened in his life, and he ruminates on the power of landscape. If you have thoughts you'd like to share with Howard Norman, if you've read his novels or have questions about his life, give us a call. 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Howard Norman, you also live part-time here in Vermont in East Callis, and I'd love for you to read a passage from one of your Vermont stories.
This is from the Vermont chapter called Kingfisher Days. And I'm trying to just describe what sponsors this whole chapter is a phrase, "Everything I love most happens every day." And I think
I love that phrase, by the way. That's a beautiful thought.
Thank you so much. It was suggested by a poem by Robert Kelly. The Independence Day parade in Cabot, the bread and puppet troupe led things off with its founder, Peter Schumann, dressed as Uncle Sam on stilts, and timeless anti-war slogans in 10-foot-wide sheets held between poles by giant, doughy-headed puppets. Ironically, next in line came a dozen World War II veterans, the breast pockets of their ill-fitting uniforms draped with medals. These elderly men walk slowly and wave to the crowd on either side of the street. I'm eating a cherry cheese Danish at Rainbow Sweets Cafe, talking about books and Russian classical music with the proprietor, William Tchaikovsky. Gabriel Dietzel up on a ladder at the back of the farmhouse, taking down last year's paper wasps' nests to use for an art project. Standing in the waist-deep water of the creek at the bottom of the dirt road, fingerling trout brushing past your knees. Kestrels, hawks, crows, sparrows, robins, towhees. At night, fireflies hover above the garden along the stone wall. I look out over the field and see thousands more. The eyes of deer rising and falling in the near dark. The radio tuned to the BBC at midnight. But of course, there's the overseas time difference, which means the European workday has already arrived at my house. Time travel by radio.
Which I suppose is something like what we're doing now.
Yes.
You never know who's listening.
Yes. I was mentioning before that I spend a lot of time in Northern California, and I'm up often late at night, and I can turn on the BBC at 3 in the morning when it's just starting up.
You seem to listen to a lot of radio. You seem to spend a lot of time in the night. You have some insomnia, I take it?
Well, it's the only time you can listen to the radio at night is at night.
That's true.
What's the John Coltrane line? If it wasn't night all the time, we wouldn't need lights. So I am up at night. I like the night. It's less insomnia, I think, than patterns, sleep patterns that shift as you age. But the radio, of course, is throughout all my novels, and it's the vehicle through which the world arrives in an isolated place. And having been in a number of these places, one would say reliance is intensified. Or perhaps I could better say that life is intensified by radio news that comes in.
You read that passage, which you said is from your Vermont chapter, and it is a whole chapter set in Vermont in this book. But I understand you actually also do most of your writing while you're here in Vermont.
I do. I mean, whatever interest that is to anyone, it is true that I've never finished a book anywhere else but Vermont. And I think the finishing means that that's where the rewriting goes on, which is mostly what writing is. But a lot of my novels are set in Atlantic Canada. And the idea is there is just to go to that place, Nova Scotia especially, to research in libraries and archives, to eavesdrop in on conversations, to register as deeply as you can speech patterns, to talk to people, to read sermons, archives of sermons in local churches, every possible level of engagement, and then come back to Vermont and write about it. So it's more about the displacement of the imagination. You live in one place, but you write about it in another.
Given that, was it more difficult to write the Vermont chapter? Did you write that here or did you have to go somewhere else? You wrote some of this book in other places.
That's a wonderful question. I hadn't thought of it. I did write it here, but I would have to think about that. I think maybe its character might be a little different if I looked at it closely. Yes, I think the thing about Northern California and Vermont for me is they're both places for whom, and I'm sure many listeners would have this experience, that I often dream about Vermont when I'm in Vermont, and then I wake up and I'm in Vermont, and dream about Northern California when I'm in Northern California, and consequently wake up and I'm looking at the landscape I've just dreamed about. So the boundary between the unconscious and the conscious is very fluid. And I might argue that that's a definition of feeling at home somewhere, but just my own idiosyncratic definition.
I'm talking with the writer Howard Norman, and if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Brooks is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Brooks. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Howard.
Hello.
I'm judging from what you said earlier about your brothers, older brothers, et cetera, in the 1950s. I'm judging that you're in your mid to late 60s.
I'm 64.
Well, that's almost mid-60s.
Unfortunately, you're right.
Pardon me?
Unfortunately, you're correct.
Getting old isn't that bad. bewilders me whether you consider yourself a writer, a philosopher, a naturalist, an anthropologist, an activist, and I believe you said earlier that you have no formal training in writing.
So, Howard, how do you characterize yourself?
Well, I think definitions are reductionist. I could probably best answer that question by talking about several people I admire. If you take a writer like Peter Matheson, who writes as brilliantly about ornithology and birds as anyone alive, he also writes novels. He also is very active in many realms, politically, socially. I think you're dealing with a life that orchestrates disparate elements into a kind of organic thing. I don't feel like I'm in that echelon, but to the caller, I hope there's nothing in any of my writing that would indicate that I was any one thing. I don't think of myself as anything but a writer. But having said that, writing is inclusive. It draws in your feelings and thoughts, and it's where you come to knowledge of yourself. So I suppose there's a philosophical element to that.
It's interesting to me that you say, you know, you think of labels as somewhat reductionist, because one of the things I noticed in this book, and I've been reading The Bird Artist as well, and I see it in there, is that you love lists. In this book, you have lists of all the birds that you visited in Saskatchewan, even though you now don't like life lists. The set list on the radio station in the Arctic the day John Lennon was murdered. You list all of the songs this DJ played.
I really made an effort to find that, Jane, because I think I wanted to do my own fact-checking. I wanted to kind of not validate but verify my memory of that, because when that happened, when John Lennon was murdered and it came in over the radio, I somehow remember that evening almost as if one could recapitulate the original chronology of things that had happened, which, of course, the mind can't really do. But I went back and at least I remembered basically the song list.
And then you tell us, and I'm curious what you think is the narrative purpose of lists, because it's clear that you feel one. You feel that they serve a purpose.
Sure.
Beyond just telling this is what happened. There's something in the list.
I think I'm influenced, if that's not too presumptuous a word, I think I'm influenced by the kind of listing poems that have been written throughout time, especially I think in the 60s and 70s. some of the poets that I was reading, they'd make these kinds of lists. And there is something incantatory about a list if it's written in the right way. It locks into a kind of cadence. And it may be the attempt to impose retrospectively a cadence on memory.
You mentioned earlier that in that lake where you killed the swan, there was also a parking area, and your brother and his girlfriend, who had quite an influence on you for one summer, would go there. And you write about this girlfriend. You write about other pretty difficult things that happened in your life, as well as some humorous moments and some wonderful things. You write about a girlfriend who was killed in a plane crash in Canada when you were a young man. And your daughter was one of your first editors in this book. Did you censor yourself because you knew she was going to read these stories?
No, not in the least, nor that would be not only comporting oneself in an undignified manner literarily, but it wouldn't be anything remotely what she would want. She was not editorial in her response. As much as she was, that is in terms of asking to take things out. In the final chapter of this novel, I address quite an untoward event that happened in our Washington, D.C. former house. And when Emma, who's now 25, a wonderful photographer living in San Francisco, read that chapter, she really insisted that I get the facts straight, that on photography, technical descriptions, and one procedural thing that I had misremembered. And
this is a story about a woman who murdered her young son and killed herself in your home.
Yes. A 40-year-old poet we did not know very well at all, just glancingly. It's sort of like no good deed goes unpunished. We left her in the house, came to Vermont, and she committed this heinous act, unforgivable, really. And that's really the chapter Emma really responded to, in the sense you describe.
Well, and she lived through it as well.
She lived through it at a distance, yes. But then, it no doubt registered with her in a way that I can't fully imagine.
Well, they're wonderful stories in this book. I really enjoyed reading it. And Howard Norman,
Thank
what a pleasure
you.
To talk with you. Thank
My
you
pleasure.
So much.
Thanks so much for having me here.
That's Howard Norman. His new book is called I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place. It's a memoir. He's going to be reading at Bear Pond Books on August 20th and Misty Valley Books on August 25th. We'll have the details up at vpr.net. Coming up, we'll tackle the concept of upcycling, making a better world the byproduct of the manufacturing process. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Monday on the program, we discussed Vermont's plan to divert recyclables, yard waste, and organic materials from the landfill. But what if products were designed to avoid the landfill altogether? What if they were created to be reused? Architect William McDonough is a 1973 graduate of Dartmouth College. He explored that concept in the 2002 book Cradle to Cradle, which he co-wrote with Michael Braungart. And they take the idea further in a new book, The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance. William McDonough will be speaking about these ideas Thursday afternoon at Dartmouth College. I spoke with him yesterday and asked him to explain the premise of upcycling.
What we've done with the upcycle is move to the next level and say, like Archimedes, who said that if you give me a lever, a fulcrum, and a place to stand, I could move the earth. We look at cradle to cradle as a fulcrum. It's a place to stand. If things are safe in biology or safe in technology, then everything's a nutrient. If that's a frame condition, then the lever that we apply to it can be applied from where we stand, in your case, Vermont, and we can start to leverage the world in propitious ways using those ideas. And so we end up eliminating the concept of waste. We restore biodiversity. We treat each other with fairness. We have clean water, clean energy. All these kinds of things start to manifest. And so The Upcycle is a book of evocations about how to take the science, the economics, the social equity issues, the technology opportunities, and reframe the design as the signals of intention for humans to make the world better
Explain what you mean by that with an example. I mean, Len, let's take your book, because you put right on the back cover of your book that this copy of the book is a demonstration of the practice of upcycling.
This book is the first book in history designed to be safe for ecological and human health, specifically even the inks and everything else. The book is safely designed for combustion even. So if you, you know, don't like it that much and you want to burn it, go ahead. It's safe. But the idea is you could actually have a book that was so safe you could boil it and serve it for porridge if you had a fiber deficiency. Why not? Why shouldn't we have safe, healthy things?
But you're also talking about other concepts in here of in the manufacturing process itself, making sure that you're not just making an object that then can get reused in a certain way, but that even in the process itself, there is good coming out of that.
Just the design of this book is the signal of that intention, and as such, paper manufacturers improve their process by removing chemicals that were untoward and adding new ones that are actually beneficial. The inks are assessed all the way down to the parts per million, parts per billion. We did it with the largest printer in America, so that the largest printer in America now knows how to make a biological nutrient book instead of just a toxic magazine. So the world got better because this book got printed, we hope.
And what about other manufacturers? I mean, how do you convince manufacturers that there's something in it for them to make sure that their process is good and their products are beneficial to the earth?
Well, I think most people are well-meaning. I think what we've found is the most potent tool to achieve these ends is simply money. We make products that are cost-effective and make money for the people who make them and benefit their customers, and we find that's the most compelling argument. And that's what businesses want to do. They want to grow, and when businesses are simply trying to be less bad all the time, which most of the eco-movement businesses are, they'll say we've reduced our badness by something. You know, we've used less paper, less weight, less poison, you know, but it's still poison and it's still whatever. And it's just less. And so what we're pointing out and did in Cradle to Cradle is that being less bad is not being good. It's just being bad, but less so. The upcycle is really about things getting better. And so we have protocols for how you can manage that and how you can turn it into prosperity. So it changes the question of capitalism from simply how much can I get for how little I give to how much can I give for all that I get.
So how would you apply this concept? Just this morning, I got an email from my cell phone company saying, hey, you're eligible for an upgrade. Don't you want a new gadget? And you think about these gadgets and everything in the context of what you've been speaking about. Not only is this a gadget that you throw away and get a new one because there's a newer model that's more exciting, but we look at a lot of the problems in manufacturing, problems with sweatshop labor in some of these gadgets. We look at e-waste and the problems that that's causing in terms of both just waste in general, but also leaching. How do we apply the upcycle to something like that that is such a consumer-driven demand at this point as well?
Well, it's quite interesting to look at the history of the relationship of people to things. But today, you know, this stuff is becoming more and more ephemeral. And instead of bemoaning it, we're going to need to honor it for what it is. Otherwise, we watch and wring our hands and complain while the world destroys itself around us. So if we look at it positively, you can think some of these are ephemera. So for many of these things, take your cell phone. We're designing electronics to come apart when you finish with them, that we can actually use adhesives that we can have let go at certain temperatures, so you can actually make the whole thing fall apart and recover all the materials and minerals and so on. So these things should all be looked at as fungible assets for future generations that are clean and healthy. And then you can celebrate the fact that you got a new phone every 3 years if they all go back and become new cell phones and other electronics without destroying the biosphere and creating jobs and coherent systems that treat people fairly and are handled safely and all those things that you were wringing your hands about.
How far away are we from your vision?
We're quite close. I mean, I'm now working on new packaging. I work with some of the biggest companies in the world. I work with the Chinese and Chinese government, and we're developing protocols with their ministry. industries, for the future of making things. It's obviously, you know, unbelievable chaos in the world right now in terms of these issues. We're seeing everything from the worst, you know, to the best. But I just got off the phone with one of the world's largest chemical companies today talking about a whole new set of chemistries for packaging because it's gone berserk. I mean, right now everybody's putting things in these pouches, and the pouches are all seven layers of indistinct plastics with toxic inks and adhesives, and it's insane. And I just the other day saw vegan kale chips, certified organic, gluten-free, in a package that it doesn't have a recycling symbol on it because you could never recycle it. It's seven types of plastic and metallized, and it weighs more than the kale chips. And yet it's a, you know, quote, green, good-for-you product, really. And when it says contents, it doesn't mention the package itself, which weighs more than the kale chips. So we've hit the wall here. This is insane. We've hit insane. And so people, when they hit a wall, they start to think, and people are thinking. So it's time, that's for sure.
That's William McDonough, author of the new book, The Upcycle. He'll be speaking at Dartmouth College tomorrow afternoon at 4 as part of the Leading Voices in Energy, Sustainability, and Security lecture series. You can find more details at vpr.net. Today marks the final day of Ramadan for Muslims around the world. Ramadan is in the ninth month of the Islamic calendar, and Muslims mark this time with prayer, charity, and daily dawn-to-dusk fasting. For Muslims who've immigrated to Vermont from other countries, observing the holiday provides a chance to both honor their religion in daily life and connect with their heritage.
My name is Sanella Oric, and I live in Winooski. Ramadan is the ninth month in the Islamic calendar. Fasting is done from dawn until sunset, and you are refraining from food, from liquids, from smoking, basically any bad habits. So it's basically a time of the month where you're purifying your soul. I have not observed Ramadan in just Vermont. I'm actually from Bosnia, and I also lived in Germany and Egypt. So here it's definitely harder because you can't take a break for every prayer at work that you need to do. So you have to make it up later on in the day. It's still beautiful that we have a mosque, somewhere where we can call a mosque or something that we can do together as a community. But it is definitely different than what I've experienced before. So for me, the significance of Ramadan is actually the iftar, which is the dinner, where we have, you know, the whole family over, and we kind of celebrate basically our fast throughout the day and just being grateful for what we have, each other, food, which is important, and basically a roof over our head, because there's always worse in the world, you know. So we always have to be, every day, not just for Ramadan, but every day we should be grateful for what we have in life. It does have an impact on me for the rest of the year. Every single day throughout Ramadan, we should expand our knowledge of Islam. And it's like a new year, you know, where we kind of like set goals for each individual, maybe in the family, maybe for like your kids or just yourself. You just want to complete something or, you know, something that you want to do for the rest of the year. So the most important thing is that we expand our knowledge in Islam and what is most important in this life.
Allahumma salli ala sayyidina Muhammadin fil awwalin. Allahumma salli ala sayyidina Muhammadin fil akhirin. Allahumma salli wa sallim wa barik ala sayyidina Muhammadin fil mala'il a'la.
That was Sanella Oric of Winooski speaking with us about Ramadan. The Ramadan prayer we're hearing right now was recorded by the Islamic Society of Vermont. Tomorrow morning, the Islamic Society will hold public prayers at the Sheraton in Burlington to mark the end of Ramadan and the beginning of Eid al-Fitr, the Feast of Fast Breaking. Details are online at vpr.net. And that'll do it for today's show. Tomorrow, we'll talk with a woman who succeeded in a field when very few women did, in the hard sciences. Cardi Raper got her PhD at the age of 52, studying the reproduction of mushrooms. We'll find out what it took to forge a career in the sciences in the late 20th century, and what women of today can learn from her experiences. Send your comments or questions to VermontEdition@vpr.net, and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson and Annie Pruitt. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.